The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, my name is Graham Oliver, the founder member of Saxon and now ODS. You're listening to Talking Metal. It's going to blow your ears off.
Welcome to the 934th episode of the Talking Metal Podcast. My name is Mark Striegel. I started this show with my good friend John Astronomy, aka John Ostrowski, back in 2005. And John still joins me here and there, especially on the live streams, but for the most part I'm pulling the show solo with help from John occasionally, like I said, and my gorgeous wife Emily Striegel, who hops on here sometimes with me. We need to get her back. Of course, Victor Ruiz, who does the bonus podcast with me on Patreon every week. The Mark Striegel podcast is available exclusively to the people who support me on Patreon, like these people: Metal Dan, John Bovary, Steve Hoker, Mike Jones, Michael Street, Fred Rutz, David Gray, James Bennett, Anthony Mackey, Jean-Francois Blah, Ron Keel, Steven Saylor, Jason Seth, Joe Ryan, Matt Carroll, Drake, Sam Soupy, Jerry from Long Island, Victor Ruiz, who I mentioned previously. He helps out and does more than help out. He really helps, is the co-host, co-producer of the shows we do on Patreon for these people that I'm reading their names right now. They're the only ones who get to hear it. I wish you'd consider joining them. Dan Gerwan, Brad Dahl, Leo from Alaska, Kenny McCrimmon, Gregory Muse, Tommy Anderson, Stephen Rodriguez, Johan Erdestrom, Chris Riley, Jeremy Weltman, Andrew Miller, Mario Charance, Sean Richmond, Gene Eugene DX, Joey Von Cherry, Glenn Watson, Victor Guzman, Blue Walsh 21, Jerry from Salt Lake City, Patrick Sabin, Denny Striegel, Ed Ferguson, John Barron, Huckney Jacobson, John Simpson, Hank Reeves, Alan Janssen, Seth B., Madison Hatter, Dane Damage, Adrian Kuzik, and Kado Yogavi. Thank you to each and every one of you guys. Let's get into the episode. All right, guys, we are rocking it with two interviews today on this show, and they are good ones. I really thoroughly enjoyed both of these. Big shout out to Poppy, Graham Oliver's granddaughter, because a number of months back, she DM'd me, and I think, I don't know if it was on YouTube or Instagram, but she had mentioned she watched a video that my wife and I did where we talk about my old Motley Crue shirt. It's up on my YouTube page. It's probably posted like 2 years ago or something. I guess she watched that. And in that, I mentioned Saxon. And she, of course, reached out and said, "Hey, my granddad is Graham from Saxon, the original Saxon guitar player who played on all those classic Saxon records." So she said, "You should interview him." And I had in the past, but I looked back and it's been 10 years already. So it's about time we reconnected again. I love Graham. I want to stay in touch with him. And I just remembered this from the last interview I did with him 10 years ago. he's just a pleasure to speak with and has so many great stories. Called him up on his cell phone there in the UK, and we had just a dandy conversation, which I'm going to play for you shortly. After that, we're going to hear from a friend of mine and Emily's, a local New Jersey, New York musician who has played internationally with so many different bands, some of them that he didn't even want to mention, which were really big name people, but I'll respect his wish and not mention them. And others that he will mention, like members of Guns N' Roses he plays with currently, and he spent some time in the great band, the Black Crowes. So we're going to hear from Rob Clores, a keyboardist. We have only interviewed a handful of keyboardists through the years. That guy Derek from Sons of Apollo, Derek Sherinian, right? I remember interviewing him years ago. I'm trying to think of what other keyboardists. I've tried to get Dizzy Reed, no luck. We've had Jordan Rudess just recently from Dream Theater. We have Rob Clores today. I'm probably missing one or two, but not many more than that. 934 episodes and hardly any keyboardists. So I welcome keyboardists on the show here. So big thanks to Rob for not only joining me, but driving to my house from where he lives in Jersey City and having an interview right here in my living room here in Maplewood, New Jersey, in the new house we just moved into. We'll hit a little bit of news, not really news, just events. I recently was watching the new video by the band White Wizard. Now, they have redone Flight of Icarus by Iron Maiden, and they really nail it. They're not reinventing the wheel with it. It's kind of done very much in the Maiden style, but I think they do an excellent job with it. And not only that, they like almost do like a frame by frame recreation of the original Iron Maiden Flight of Icarus video, which I used to have on a Betamax cassette, video cassette, because my family was one of the ones that had Betamax instead of VHS, because we were told Betamax was a higher quality, which I know from working in video it was. However, VHS was the thing that took off, but we had it on Betamax, and I remember paying some insane amount of money for it. It was the official Iron Maiden video collection. It was like three videos or four videos. I believe it was Run to the Hills, Number of the Beast, Flight of Icarus, and The Trooper. I believe that was what was on that for music videos. But anyways, fun to see White Wizard recreate not only the sounds of Iron Maiden, but the primitive video editing techniques of pre-Avid, pre-digital editing back in the day with the video. Great job by John Leon and the guys in White Wizard. Would love to connect with John at some point to talk White Wizard, a band that has had a history with the podcast. We've had them on many, many times through the years. And then for some reason, right after the White Wizard video played on YouTube, it just defaulted to the new Night Ranger song, Breakout, which I had not seen. And that just put a smile on my face, seeing Brad Gillis up there doing his solo, and of course Jeff Watson is no longer in the band, but just seeing the guys up there playing, and thought the song was decent, a fun video. So there you have it, Night Ranger with new music out. Apparently there's a new record. I haven't heard the record, but I did hear the one song, watch the video for Breakout. Definitely, if you were even a casual Night Ranger fan back in the day, it's worth checking that out. Fun stuff. And what else? I hope everyone had a happy July 4th. I'm actually recording this before the 4th, because I'm going to be traveling and working simultaneously for the next couple weeks. We're going to kind of be jumping around a little bit, but mostly out in Indiana. So there you go, guys. Let's do this. The first interview, again, is with this legendary guy. His name is Graham Oliver. What a history with this guy. We talk about it all, jamming with Dio, the Great Denim and Leather album, Power and the Glory, so much discussed here, as well as what he's up to now. And a big shout out to Poppy. We will link her Instagram page in the show notes on talkingmetal.com and right there in your podcasting app. Of course, Poppy is Graham's granddaughter. So there you go. All right. Again, a true honor to speak with this guy. Here we go. My interview with Graham. Hey, it's Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and what an honor to have back on the show. It's been 10 years since I've spoken with this guy, but we have Graham Oliver back on the show, the legendary guitar player of Saxon fame. Graham, how are you?
Hi, Mark. I'm absolutely fine, thank you.
Yeah, it's been a while, man. 10 years. A lot has changed. I mean, we're coming off of this very strange time in history with COVID and quarantine and all that stuff. How are you faring personally and professionally?
Well, everything. I mean, we started off in 2020 with a great year, but we played Finland in January, a metal fest, indoor metal fest. And then we did Giants of Rock in the UK in February. And then everything hit the buffers. We got festivals, two dates in Tokyo, festivals in Germany, France, Holland, Belgium, UK. It was going to be ODS's probably biggest year since we started, you know, nearly 20 years ago. So it's just frustrating for most bands, not only us, it's been the whole world. I mean, Roger Waters from Pink Floyd said in an interview that some people will have played the last gig without even knowing it.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably true.
Well,
hopefully we're not one of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, hopefully not for you guys. And when you say we, you're talking about Oliver Dawson, the band you have with longtime partner, right? That you worked with way back in Saxon days, Steve Dawson on bass.
Yeah, well, Steve Dawson actually and myself actually founded Saxon, and we actually invited Biff and Paul to join. So Steve, with that, you know, Steve, it was Steve that actually heard Biff singing, and he was a bass player, Biff, at the time, and he just sang on some demos, and Steve got a chance to listen to them. And he said this guy could be a great singer. So it's all down to Steve Dawson, really, Biff's career.
Wow, very interesting. And I do want to talk more about your history with Saxon, but...
I mean, we're proud of that.
Yeah, you should be.
And, I mean, the gold album stopped about late 80s when me and Steve, when the original five, were working together as a collective, I think the success was the greatest because it was a great songwriting team. I mean, when I wrote Power and the Glory and Wheels of Steel, I only wrote the riffs, and the band came together and worked, like I said, as a collective and did the arrangement. It was a good, great teamwork, and it was a chemistry that worked. So as soon as that were disrupted, I mean, Pete Gill was a great drummer for writing songs with as well.
Right.
And as was Nigel Glockler later on, you know.
Right. Yeah. Power and the Glory. One of my favorite records. But you mentioned Pete Gill. Let's talk about the 40-year anniversary of Denim and Leather. I don't know if you know that. 1981. Here we are 40 years later. The great Saxon album, Denim and Leather. Any memories of that record, making that record, writing that record?
Yeah, I remember recording it in Geneva. And I know, Paul, one day we were designated for solos, guitar solos, and Paul Quinn went so much overtime because he loves to play lead solos, you can't stop him. I think I got 4 hours in the studio before the time was up to get a couple of solos down. But I remember it being a fun time and going out on boats in Geneva, speed boats, me and Pete Gill, when Biff were doing his vocals, you know. Yeah, I'll try and talk slow because Yorkshire accents sometimes can be a bit tough.
But while we're still on this record, Denim and Leather, I want to just mention a few of the songs that have become such classics. Of course, Princess of the Night. Any memories of that song coming together?
Yes. I mean, that's a Paul Quinn riff. anything complicated and fast for Paul Quinn. My riff would end him in leather, which is pretty basic, but sometimes the basic ones,
right,
like Power and the Glory and Hungry Years, tend to become classics. I think simple, sometimes you can get a good groove. But the thing that freaked me out with Princess of the Night is how fast Paul Quinn wanted to play the riff.
Yeah.
It was like early speed metal.
Well, it really was, and it was for that time, such a revolutionary record and strong record, and holds up to this day. You mentioned the title track, Denim and Leather, is just such a classic, but other ones like And the Band Played On, just still such a powerful song when you hear that.
Yeah.
How about that one? Any memories of that song?
Yeah, I mean, one morning when we were doing pre-production, I heard Robin Trower playing Whiskey Train when he was with Procol Harum. I think it was recorded about 1969. And I thought, that's a cool riff. And so I think Robin Trower did it in A. And I kind of thought, I'll take that as an idea and take it to Paul. So I transposed a similar kind of riff. I used it as a springboard, I didn't copy it.
Inspiration.
An inspiration. And I did a riff in E, and Paul put the guitar on, and then we took it to the band, and the band sort of made it into this tune. So yeah, that's how that started.
And of course, Pete Gill, you mentioned him earlier, he handled the drums on Denim and Leather. Lemmy wrote about Pete in his book, and he was a part of Motorhead for a while. Any memories you could share about Pete Gill?
Yeah, I'll confuse what Lemmy said in his book, and I asked Lemmy about it, and his answer was, I don't know why I put it, but Pete Gill tried to bed as many girls as possible. That's why I found the quote that you're referring to a little bit strange. And so... But Pete Gill was a good-looking guy, and he got all the girls. And I still talk to Pete. We've been in contact occasionally. And so we're still friends. And me, Pete, and Steve are meeting up soon. So maybe we'll do it on the 40th anniversary, do a photo, and put it on the internet.
Right on. So basically, in Lemmy's book, he implies that possibly Pete could be gay, not that there's anything wrong with that, or bisexual, but you're saying that's just simply not true.
Well, I never saw any evidence of that in all the years I was with Pete Gill. Like I said, Pete Gill's quest was to bed as many girls as possible.
Right on. And
from 77 onwards to 82.
Right on. I do want to talk to you more about your incredible history, but while I'm thinking of it, like I said, I interviewed you 10 years ago, almost to the month, but this, I want to give a shout out to your granddaughter, because she had reached out to me on Instagram and said, you need to interview my granddad. And that was, I was like, wow, I haven't spoken with Graham in a while. So I just wanted to give her a shout out. She's a metal fan?
She's a massive metal fan, Poppy Oliver. She's the most rock chick of rock chicks, even though she's my granddaughter. She was born in the wrong decade.
Wow.
I mean, she's 22. She knows, she's just crazy on Motley Crue. She knows all the metal tracks. She knows all the lyrics. She's just a total metalhead. And it's her biggest wish to get a message off Nikki Sixx. So I've talked to a couple of people, but it's hard to track him down.
Yeah, he's hard to get in touch with. I interviewed him many years ago, probably like 12 years ago, but... haven't had him back on. We had Mick Mars on the show a couple years back.
Yeah. Well, the first time we met Motley Crue is we were playing the Whiskey a Go Go. I think it was 81 or 82. Can't remember exactly. And Metallica was our support group, their second ever gig. And we were in the dressing room with Ozzy Osbourne and Sharon. And Randy Rhoads had been killed, I think, just about 2 weeks before. So it was really hard. We didn't know what to say to Ozzy. We were distraught, you know. It kind of put a cloud over our debut gig in LA, you know.
Yeah.
At the Whiskey. And about an hour into the dressing room banter, a big bang at the door came. Bang, bang, bang. The door flung open. Our tour manager came in and said, "Hey guys, there's a band here from a local band from LA called Motley Crue. My favourite ever song is Motorcycle Man, and they really want to meet you." And then a couple of years later, we ended up supporting them on tour.
Right on.
Which you could write an old book about.
Yeah, well, that was my first concert, by the way, seeing Saxon and Motley Crue at the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago, Illinois. I believe it was early 84, I want to say, 1984. And what a show for me. What a great way for me to start off my love of rock and roll and concerts in general. So you mentioned you could write a whole book on that. What were some memories, any party memories, any fun little stories you could share with us briefly here on the podcast about touring with Motley Crue back in 1984?
Well, they were banned from most hotels for a start. The reputation preceded them. But when we got in bars, the girls would do anything to get to Motley Crue. And I mean anything. And Tommy Lee had a briefcase full of Polaroids that he used to entertain people with in the small hours. I'll not tell you what were on the Polaroids. But, yeah, it was unbelievable. It was an unbelievable time because MTV was just starting up and the guys were getting massive MTV coverage. And it was sort of reminded me a bit of glam rock in the 70s where they were more dressing up, you know, as well as the music. And being looking cool and that, instead of leather jackets and just denims, you know. But it were great times. I just wish that in those days there was mobile phones like there were, that you could take pictures so instantaneously and footage.
Right.
It would be great to see stuff because it was early days and, you know, it'd just be great to have a record of some of that time rather than just a memory.
Right on, right on. And you mentioned Ozzy Osbourne earlier, and you guys toured with Ozzy, is that correct? The Saxon did?
Yeah, we did a full European tour with Ozzy.
And that was when, with Randy, actually, right? That was Randy.
Yeah, with Randy.
Yeah.
And they were our support group, because Saxon at that point in time was that big in Europe. That's what I mean, the time with, you know, me and Steve Dawson was, Saxon were huge, and I even got to jam with Randy because we used to have a tune-up room where, because Randy used to like to practice before pre-gig, and I mean, took real care of himself, his appearance. He was such a nice person, and he was practicing constantly, and he really took a fancy to my Flying V because I've got a very rare Flying V with a white Gibson with block inlays. They only made 25, apparently.
Wow.
And so anyway, I took it into the practice room and I was warming up. Randy came in and said, "Hey, man, can I ever go on your guitar?" And to cut a long story short, we ended up doing Jimi Hendrix's Red House, me on Randy's Spotted Jackson type guitar.
Yeah.
And he played my Flying V, which was, if I had that on mobile phone video,
yeah,
that would be unbelievable.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, you mentioned to me, I don't know if this is public knowledge and or it's anything you can talk about, but you mentioned to me you were doing some sort of video production or something up in Liverpool. Any light you can shed on that, or is that not announced yet?
It's nothing to do with my music. I was invited to play, I don't know if you've heard a group called T-Rex.
Okay.
And Mark Bolan.
Right.
There's a song called 20th Century Boy. And they wanted to feature it in the film. And it's a Warner Brothers production. And filming took all day yesterday.
Oh, wow.
So I had to learn 20th Century Boy and play it about 28 times yesterday.
Nice.
It was shot live and recorded live.
Oh, cool. Great
and
song.
So all the different camera angles had to be done. So the tune had to be played and played over and over again. But it was a fun day, and it was great to be back on stage again and playing guitar because I needed to do it. And so it's due for release. It's called Ball and Shoes, the movie, I think. It's going to be on Netflix.
Oh, really? Wow.
It's out in September 2022.
Okay. All right. Well, a little ways off, but we will try to remember that, and I'm sure it's going to be great because Netflix does some really good productions.
Yeah. I think it's a story about Mark Bolan, but I'm not sure how much he'll end up in the movie. But we did shoot the entire song over and over again, so if they use a minute and a half, it'll still be cool, you know, to be in it.
Right on. And when you look back on your career with Saxon, do you have a favorite album?
I think because I had such a lot to do with this particular songwriting and the riffs, I think Power and the Glory.
Yeah,
we recorded in Atlanta, in Georgia, with Ted Glicksman, Jeff Glicksman, sorry, producing, who were a great producer for guitars. He understood guitars, brilliant. And living in Atlanta, it was for about 6 weeks. We had such a fun time recording it. It was pretty guitar orientated with Jeff. Because sometimes when we recorded like Crusader with the producer, that Kevin Beamish, it weren't really how I were hearing it, you know, it was a bit more, even though America said it was too English heavy metal to play it on the radio, Crusader.
Right.
But I think Power and the Glory really is the one, because I came up with the riff. In fact, the chorus, the verse part, I shouldn't be giving away all these ideas, but the inspiration for that was Emotional Rescue, the Rolling Stones.
Oh, wow, wow.
You know, I just slowed the riff. Da, 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 da. I just heard that and I thought, that's a cool progression. I'll just play it and slow it down, and that became the verse.
Wow, that's great. That's great. Yeah, my favorite Saxon record, by the way. And a lot of times I talk with Saxon fans, they're like, oh, no, you know, Wheels of Steel or Denim and Leather. But I really, really love Power and the Glory. And there was definitely, in my opinion, the sound evolved on that record for Saxon. It was a little bit more, I don't know, like almost, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but almost it sounded a little more 80s, a little more contemporary than the albums that came before it.
Yeah. And because what Jeff did, he put a Marshall cabinet and a GMC 800 in a wooden box. They made a crate and put all mics into it. And my SG into that. Then you could crank the amplifier up really loud and without it feeding back. Because I like to play in the studio rather than control room. Because when you're in the control room trying to do solos, there's people jerking off. That's an English term. I know it means something different in America. But people acting, talking, and, you know, generally acting the fool, and it's distracting. So I used to like to go in the studio and feel the guitar in your butt, you know.
Right, yeah.
Feel the vibrations from the cab or the box that Jeff made.
Do you still record that way? Do you use actual amps? There's so many bands nowadays, they just, you know, use these Kempers, or they plug in and they get the sound.
Yeah. I've only ever used a Kemper once in Spain last year.
Yeah.
We did a few dates in Spain, and we were using hired gear, and it were a Kemper. And when you're trying to play the intro to Hungry Ears, quiet, I'm an old school player where I use the volume on the to do the intro, and then you crank it up when it comes into the riff, and the noise gate as I was trying to turn it off, and it's not for me. I'll definitely be old school forever, Marshall amp or 100 watt amp, whatever, you know, as long as it's a good make with tubes, I can make it sound like me usually. Because when you do a lot of festivals like we do in Europe, you just fly in there with your guitars and everything's rented. Sometimes you might get an Engel amplifier, or you might get the ones that Rush use, German ones, I just forget what they call them now. So it just depends, you know, you can ask for amplifiers, but, and then so most times, like we did Headbangers, you don't even see the stage before you go on and plug into the amplifier. So you've got like 20 minutes to plug in and tune up and away you go. I mean, that's how these festivals work.
Right.
So, yeah, so it's really, it's good schooling, because a lot of it sharpens your chops up, because you've got to be using your guitar and your sound.
Right.
And without relying on pedals and long sound checks and as a crutch, you know. So you've got to go on there and kick ass, basically. So it's just down to experience, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes total sense. Mm. And let's talk about Oliver Dawson. You mentioned before you guys are working on new music. Did you say that earlier?
Yeah, well, ODS, as we just abbreviate it to ODS usually. But promoters like to use Oliver Dawson, so people know who we are.
Right.
Steve's been writing at home. I've been writing at home. And hopefully we can come together in the next couple of months with Bri, our singer.
Yep.
And Gavin, who plays guitar now, he's been writing at home. And we can pull our ideas and start working as a band, possibly for an EP or an album release in 2022. But Steve's had to isolate for so long because he's got a medical condition that made him a high risk.
Oh, okay.
For the COVID, you know.
Yeah.
So it's been difficult. He's been under the hospital. So, you know, it's trying times. And we ain't getting any younger, you know. So we've got to really put his foot to the gas and try and get a move on. So hopefully we'll get something out. But his last studio album was Motorbiker.
Yeah, that was like 2012, right?
2012, yeah. And then we did a live album. And we were to do another live DVD. It's all been recorded in Scotland. But because BMG own everything, we can't release it for 8 years.
Oh, wow.
So that's a bit of a drag.
Yeah.
But it's just how it is. Because BMG bought out EMI, it's all complicated. And all the band members benefited by it. It was a good thing. It just means that there's some things that have to be put on hold from both myself and ODS and presumably Biff's version of the band as well.
Right. Right. Do you ever talk with Biff? You guys ever cross paths, ever speak with him?
I don't talk with Biff, but Paul Quinn Freak, we're very stay in touch. We visit each other's homes. And in 2019, in December, both myself and Paul Quinn flew to Sardinia in Italy to do a guitar festival.
Oh, wow.
With Uli John Roth.
Oh, cool.
And it was the first time we played together since 1995. We did Denim and Leather, Motorcycle Man, and Princess of the Night.
Wow, since 1995, wow.
Yeah. And then we joined Uli John Roth on stage for the grand finale to do, I think we did All on the Watchtower and Uli's version of Atlantis, which is the tune that Hendrix finished Woodstock with in 1969. It's in A minor.
Cool.
Like a guitar piece, instrumental.
Right on. So, Graham, where did you grow up?
I grew up between Sheffield and Doncaster in Yorkshire.
Right on. And what are some of your earliest musical memories?
Well, my first ever concert, my brother, who was 5 years older than me, he had tickets to see the Rolling Stones, and there was a minibus going. So it was a youth club, a church youth club. And so to use the ticket, they took me along. I was 12 years old, so my initiation into music was at a Rolling Stones concert, sat just in the balcony above Brian Jones.
Wow.
That were awesome then. And then about 66, I went to see Spencer Davis Group, and Stevie Winwood got up off the organ, put on a white Stratocaster and played a track called Stevie's Blues by Spencer Davis. You have to check it out. It's so much like Red House. It's unbelievable. And that blew my mind. I thought, that's what I want to do. And a year later, I went to see Jimi Hendrix. And that completely blew my mind. As a 15, well, 14, actually. So a lot of what we were doing were over my head because you'd never seen anything like it. So I've been blessed to see guitar all the way through to Steve Vai and Joe Bonamassa and everything in between, you know. Yeah. So I've seen all facets of guitar in its evolvement and being a part of it. I mean, I've sort of sat down and talked guitar with Tony Iommi because we both have a similar handicap. I lost a finger end on my left hand when I was 24 years old.
Wow.
And so Tony Iommi, on the Black and Blue tour, was Joyce to Colton and Black Sabbath to him, Evan and Al. And we'd just done Rush for a month. Then we went on to AC/DC Back in Black. Then we went on to Black Sabbath and then and Joyce to Colton.
That was when Dio was in the band, right?
Dio, yeah. And we tried all Tony's finger ends on my finger, but none of them fitted. It was hilarious.
Do you use like a finger, like a little thing on the end of your finger that was lost or not?
No, I've just had, because I've lost so much, nearly an inch of it.
Right.
I've just had to learn to overcome it and just do the best I can. So I have to make one note sound like 20.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a drag, to be honest, when you see first finger vibrato people like Bonamassa,
right,
and Eric Johnson, and so I check out all guitar players. You know, I just love guitar music, no matter what kind it is. But I just have to live with it. That's all.
Well,
and I ain't done too bad, you know.
Well, as a listener of the music that you've given us, it's never hurt anything that you do, because you've given us just such great music through the years. And we appreciate the gift of that music as listeners, as fans. Yeah. As I mentioned, seeing you guys open for Motley Crue, you know, I'll tell you something. Back in 1984, I love Motley Crue too, but you guys took the energy out of the room. I mean, by the time Motley Crue, because it was Heavy Penton opened, and then Saxon came on, and then by the time Motley Crue hit, people were tired because Saxon you guys just beat us over the head, you know? I mean, you guys were so on fire that night. So it's a great memory for me, and just so glad you're still doing music, and we would love to get you guys over here in America at some point. I don't know if that's ever possible.
Yeah, I wish. I mean, we finally got to Japan in 2019, and we had a great concert that were all recorded and filmed. I think some bits of it are on YouTube. And so our biggest wish was to try and get to America. It was so difficult with the visa situation since 9/11. And without having massive record company support, you know, it's difficult.
Right, right. Well,
it's even more difficult now with this COVID thing.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed that it happens sometime.
Because Ronnie James Dio remembered, we actually did the Killing the Dragon UK tour guest band with Ronnie.
Oh, wow.
And we smoked it every night. In fact, Ronnie invited me to the stage in Portsmouth at the Pyramids venue. He says, "Graham, will you come on stage and play Rainbow in the Dark with me for the encore?" And I just says, "Let me think about that for a nanosecond."
Right.
So I did. And, you know, it was nearly 30 years to the day since I'd seen Richie Blackmore's Rainbow with Ronnie in Manchester. And a couple of days after that, I had my accident where I lost my finger end. And I was told I'd never play a guitar again. And then exactly to the anniversary of that, I was on stage with Ronnie Dio playing Rainbow in the Dark.
Wow.
Which was unbelievable for me. It was a, you know, such a surreal moment in my life.
How did you lose your finger, Graham? Was it just a...
It got slammed in the door.
Oh, okay.
The wind blew the door shut.
Damn.
I didn't get my hand out of the way in time.
But, yeah.
It crushed. It just took it off.
Yeah, so that happened after, you said right around the same time you saw Ronnie in Rainbow, and then here you were many years, many decades later, actually on stage with Ronnie playing Rainbow in the Dark. And, great stuff.
And the Goldridge, yeah. And Jimmy Bain, who also in Rainbow.
Yeah, rest in peace, Jimmy Bain. Yeah, great stuff. Yeah. We are going to have to wrap it up, Graham, but it has been great.
Well, it's such a pleasure talking to you, Mark.
Yeah, man, it's been great. We gotta do it again. We can't let another 10 years go by. Let's hook up in a year or so and do another one.
Yeah, we'll bring you up to date. By that time, we should have recorded something. But it's been an absolute pleasure, and it's how we just keep playing the music. And if people checked out the Son of a Beach album, I think that album's a great underrated. It's a bit like Montrose album. It's appreciated, but it's not massively known when it first came out. So and Motorbiker, I think there's some good tunes on there.
Right on, definitely. We will definitely hype those records, the albums that you've been doing. And again, we hope for new music. It sounds like hopefully we'll get it. And all the best of luck to you. And thanks to your granddaughter, Poppy, you said, right? Poppy?
Yeah, Poppy Oliver.
Yeah, because she really inspired me to get back in touch with you.
Cheers. She loves to get Instagrams or whatever they're called.
Right on.
So if anybody wants to find a Poppy Lee Oliver, I'm sure she'd love it.
Absolutely. Cool.
On social media.
All right. Thank you so much, sir. And reach out anytime.
Thank you, Mark. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise.
Yep. You'll talk soon anyway. It'll not be as long next time.
Okay. Yep. We'll hook up soon. I'll touch base with you every now and again just to see how you're doing.
And stay safe.
Yeah, you too.
In the heat wave as well that you're having. I don't know if
it's very hot here. Very hot here. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, then you'll take care.
All right. Take care. Have a good day. Big thanks to Graham Oliver for joining me again on the Talking Metal podcast. We cannot let another 10 years go by before he revisits us. We got to get him back on like sooner than later because I love that guy, Graham Oliver of Saxon. And one of my first concerts, really. I mean, there had been a few. I'd seen Chuck Mangione with my parents when I was a youngster a couple times. I remember a band play at my junior high school. They did a loud rock thing that was supposed to be a dance, but they ended up just rocking us all. But what I consider my first true rock concert was Saxon with Motley Crue at the Aragon Ballroom. Great memory. And without further ado, let's get into a in-person interview with Rob Cloris, formerly of the Black Crowes, currently working with guys in Guns N' Roses. So let's talk to him right now and find out what's going on. Hey, it's Mark Striegel, and I am sitting here doing another in-person interview at a house I just moved into, and so it's the first interview here at the new house, and again, one of our first in-person interviews. We've done a number of them now since quarantine, and we don't get a lot of keyboardists on the show, but today we have another one. We just had Jordan Rudess of Dream Theater, and now we have a very different style of keyboardist, but yet another keyboardist, Rob Cloris. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Mark.
Thank you for coming here. And we got the dogs jumping around here.
Yeah, but we're in person. It's like, like we're back to normal.
Yeah, it feels good and sometimes a little weird. You know, I don't know. It's still to, like, I love having you here, but to have people come hang out at my house is still like kind of a different feeling than what I'm used to, and weird in a good way, if you will.
Yes, I agree. It's all that, but we're here. We're 5 or 6 feet apart, and we're doing an interview.
Right, and we're both vaccinated, so we don't need to be. But you sent me something that I listened to recently that I just really thought was great. I love Jimi Hendrix. I think he's just one of the greatest, you know, not everyone says guitar player, but his songs were so good, you know? And you sent me a cover version that you did, and you got some pretty significant, at least one significant person, maybe others, on the track with you. Tell me about this Hendrix cover that you recently did and who's on it with you.
Well, I call it a reimagined version of Foxy Lady, and that's such a great iconic song, and I changed it up quite a bit. I kept the melody, I kept the lyrics, but I reharmonized the song, and I changed the meter to 7/8, and then it goes into 4/4, and I completely changed the chord structure and the groove of the song, and right. it was fun.
And who's playing on it with you? Because it sounds great.
Yeah, well, it's featuring Richard Fortus on lead guitar, as you may know. He's the along with Slash, the guitarist in Guns N' Roses.
Absolutely.
And he was down to do it. He enjoyed it, and now I owe him a favor.
Right on. And let's talk about you and Richard, because Richard has a history in the New York City area with the clubs and the bands there, and before, I guess he's out in LA now, right? But before, I know he used to live down on like Grand Street,
yeah,
right near where I lived in on the Lower East Side.
He's actually back in St. Louis, I believe now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're kind of where he's from, I think.
And what's your history with him? How far back does it go?
We played together in the early 2000s. We did some gigs around town. We did some recordings. So we've kind of always kept in touch, and he thought he was the right guy for right. this song.
And he sounds just great on it. And the title that it's released under, or the artist, the band, the project, is Split Second Meltdown, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
That is my solo project.
Check.
Slash band.
Right. Okay, cool. And there's other music out there by Split Second Meltdown, because when you sent me the track, I actually went on Apple Music and I started pulling up other tracks. Can you talk about the history of this band? There's at least another EP out, right?
Yeah. I came out with an EP last year, a 5-song EP, and the first session I did for that, I had John DeServio from Black Label Society on bass. I recorded at his studio, and Bob Pantella from Monster Magnet Atomic Bitchwax on drums. And I kind of knew that I wanted to do like a guitar bass rock record. So I went to JD and we recorded a bunch of songs, and a few of those songs made the EP. But then as I was searching for my sound, I did sessions with a couple other friends from LA, Charlie Paxson on drums and Saul Walker on bass. And I got that EP together.
Nice. And is there a plan for another full length or EP with this Hendrix cover? Like where can people hear the Hendrix cover? And is it for some sort of compilation or album? Or
not as of yet. It's a one-off, it's a single. I just had the idea to reimagine this song, and right now it's a one-off, so it's you can stream it everywhere in the States,
awesome, cool. And you are also known for being a part of kind of what I consider a New York City staple. I think I saw you once in Jersey City, actually. Mule Kick, which Richard Fortus has actually been a part of here and there, right?
Or he sat in with us when he's in town. But Mule Kick is a fun band. It's started by Frank Ferrer, the drummer of Guns N' Roses,
and former resident of Maplewood, actually.
Yes,
where you
yes.
are right now. Yeah.
And he wanted to get a small group together to do cool covers and just have fun and play around. So whenever Richard was in town, he would sit in with us as well,
right?
And it's a lot of fun. I think Dizzy Reed came and sat in.
Oh wow, that's cool.
Once, we have some heavyweights coming to sit in with us.
Absolutely, and you guys
are just a powerhouse when you see you play live. Is there a plan for Mule Kick to return now?
Well, there is a date in the books. I believe it's August 4th, 2021, okay, at Arlene's Grocery.
Right.
Guns N' Roses are playing the next day at MetLife Stadium, so that's why Frank is in town.
And oh, awesome!
We're going to hopefully pack him in at Arlene's Grocery on August 4th.
Awesome, August 4th. I'm trying to think I think we're actually away that week, but if we are in town, I will absolutely be there. And I wanted to give a shout out to Rob Bailey, also plays in Mule Kick, a guy I've known since the 80s, a longtime friend of mine. And when did you and Rob first connect? Was it through Frank?
We kind of connected here and there, but that was really the first project that we were involved in together, the Mule Kick project. And I played with their other project, Pisser, with Eric Toast.
Right, yep.
And, yes, and we have Brett Bass on bass, by the way, with Mule Kick and Pisser.
Right on. And, no, Pisser has new music coming out. Are you involved with that at all?
I'm not. I played on several songs on their B-side. It's cover songs, but it's like Barry White cover songs done in a rock way. So I really hope it comes out because it's quite quite different and entertaining and cool the way they arranged that. Maybe that's where I got the gig, the idea for Foxy Lady, just because they did like Can't Get Enough of Your Love, Babe, and you know, making it sound like AC/DC. So maybe that was inspiration for me doing Foxy Lady in 7/8.
Right on. And I do want to get into your history because you've played with some incredible artists, including the Black Crowes and David Johansen. We want to talk about all that. But let's talk about Madison Hatter. She was on the show recently and has some new, really strong music out that I've been enjoying. And you were a big part of that. Can you talk about your involvement with her, who she is, and what you guys do?
Larissa is Madison Hatter, and she is an awesome singer and an awesome person. And we had a lot of fun. Rob Bailey, who we spoke about earlier, he produced the tracks on her record, and with Frank on drums and Brett on bass, and I played some synthesizers on her record and some organ, and I think maybe a piano note or two. And very, very excited.
Cool. And we mentioned the Black Crowes. Can you talk a little bit about your history with them?
I did a tour with the Black Crowes and did some studio work with them. And
what year was this?
This was 2006, 2007. And it was a great experience. It was pretty thrilling as a keyboard player to step in and do a tour with those guys. Their drummer Steve Gorman wrote a book about the band, and he had some nice things to say about me, but I think everything in that book is probably true.
Really? Yeah, I've heard about that book. It's getting a big push. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody heard. You know, everybody hears stories about them. But you know what? They wrote some great music, and as a player and you know a fan of their music, it was really thrilling to go on tour with them.
Very cool. So there's been some other significant people you've played with that I do want to mention. You mentioned to me before we started recording here, Tom Jones, which I think that sounds awesome. And you guys played a really significant concert that I've been, you know, I've never been to it, but I've been following the Bridge School Benefit concerts by one of my favorite rockers, Neil Young. He puts these concerts on every year. And you got to play that with Tom Jones, is that correct?
Yeah. That was pretty thrilling as well. He did like bluesy versions of his hits. And playing Bridge School was a real treat. And I think the other artists on the bill were quite happy to watch as well, because this was back in 2014, but we had like the whole
Soundgarden band and the whole Pearl Jam band watching us side the stage, you know, well, watching Tom, because he's, you know, he's just an amazing, you know, legendary singer. And I mean, the guy can still belt it out. And that right there is impressive for like, he was maybe 80 at the time or so, at least in his late or close. And he really put on a show. So I think those, you know, everybody was very impressed.
Very cool. And David Johansen, you played some gigs with him. What's your history with him?
Yeah.
Legendary guy.
Yeah. He had the shows that I did. They were, from the Dolls book and from his solo stuff. So I didn't have to play any, Buster Poindexter.
Right. Okay.
Which was cool. That was very, piano and organ heavy. And I mean, he's just, you know, freakishly he's just really talented and such a character and, you know, very charismatic and a very nice guy. So that was fun to play with him.
And out of all these guys that you've played with, I know John Popper, you did some work with him too, of Blues Traveler fame. Who were the easiest to work with? Who were the most difficult to work with?
Well, I would say, I mean, Johansen was very was easy. Tom Jones was just he was really easy to work with, and he was still drinking at the time as I was, and we would have some drinks and stay up till 3 a.m. on a couple of occasions.
And he was pushing 80 at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, just telling us stories, just stories and stories. And he's got, you know, amazing stories, you know. I mean, he had just gotten knighted a few years earlier, so I asked him about the Queen, you know. I
said,
So how's the Queen, Tom? Like, what type of lady is she? And he's like, "Well, I've known her for 40 years."
Wow.
and it just dawned on me, like, of course you have, because you were famous in 1966, and she was the Queen, you know. And you're from Wales, and so just really amazing stuff like that.
Difficult people to work with, or don't you want to go there?
Well, no, I mean, all I can say is all the stories in Steve Gorman's book are true, and although I can't say that those guys were difficult, because they were actually they were nice and they were respectful, and I think they were appreciative that I stepped in with 2 weeks' notice and no rehearsal and learned like 95 originals and 30 covers, and I gotta say, I did a great job.
Right.
So I think it was more like, this guy is kind of saving our ass, and so you know what, I'm not gonna say that they were difficult. I mean, maybe to other people they are, but they were not difficult to me. So everyone I've ever worked with has not ever been difficult.
Really? Okay, there you go. And growing up, when did you start playing keyboards, and who were some of your initial influences? What got you into music?
Well, I got to say, my family got me into music. My dad played piano and guitar, and he'd have all kind of the music he was into. He was into like country, but like country like George Jones and like Johnny Cash, and he was into jazz, he was into Lester Young, he was into Billie Holiday, he was into R&B like Ray Charles, R&B, he was into Stevie Wonder.
Was he a musician? Did he play? Or
he was a musician for fun, which is really a great thing to be,
right?
A musician for fun, you know, because that's why we, you know, one should be a musician, really, for fun, either amateur or professional. But I took I took the classical piano lessons. I got older, I took jazz lessons, but I always loved rock and roll, and I think I saw the album cover of Led Zeppelin 1 in my uncle's record collection when I was 10 or 11, and I put it on, and I was just hooked.
Right.
So I was really, really into
the first Led Zeppelin record.
Yes.
Yeah.
And but you know, growing up in New York or New Jersey, rock and roll radio was big. So I was into being a keyboardist. I was into Deep Purple. I was into. I tended to like the heavier bands. I loved Zeppelin. But actually, my first concerts were. So I think my first concert was. If it wasn't Ozzy. Ozzy was my second concert, but it was actually Black Sabbath, but I think it was with Dio.
Okay.
And I was just always drawn to real kind of heavy,
right?
A guitar based rock. Being a keyboardist, I always really appreciated like what John Paul Jones did with Led Zeppelin, like real tasteful parts, real sounds that were diverse and fit the music. So those were some early influences.
Yeah. One of my favorite keyboardists in a rock song is No Quarter by Zeppelin. John Paul Jones on the keyboard, such great stuff. And when you look back, as you've had a long career and history as a keyboardist, as a musician, what are some of the highlights for you?
I would say a couple I mentioned, you know, playing with the Black Crowes and playing with that Bridge School with Tom Jones, traveling has been fun. I've gotten to travel to places I never thought that I would ever go.
Like where?
Like Moscow,
wow.
The pyramids of Giza,
Who were you in Moscow with?
I was with a Latin pop star that I will not mention the name, but okay. I think Fortis was on that as well,
right?
But you got to pay the bills.
Sure, right, yeah.
But the travel of the whole thing is very satisfying, and those concerts, and there's some dogs fighting here,
right?
But they're just playing.
Yeah,
they love each other.
All right, I'll clean this up.
Okay, sorry.
no problem. So before I let you go, let's take it back to Split Second Meltdown. Again, the Great Foxy Lady cover is out. People can listen to that on Spotify, Apple Music, everywhere, you said, right?
Yes, it is streamable everywhere, and I hope people enjoy it. Hope they kind of have an open mind, but it's definitely rocking, and Fortis is incredible on it, so just for that you should listen to it.
Absolutely. Split Second Meltdown. And again, there's other music up there on the streaming services by Split Second Meltdown too. But what about the future? Do you have new music you're working on? What's gonna happen in the future with Split Second Meltdown?
Yes, I'm working on some new music, and as the last the EP came out in a pandemic, I'm hoping to get a bunch of musicians in a room and record 10 songs. I mean, maybe it'll be the Mule Kick guys. I mean,
right.
I wish it were, I have to do it around Frank's touring schedule, but, so look out for some new music later this year.
Right on. And one last question. You mentioned Frank, who's a big part of Mule Kick and also the big part of the current version of Guns N' Roses. He is the drummer. He's been there a long time, actually, playing with Guns N' Roses. When did you first meet Frank? Do you remember meeting him for the first time?
I met him probably in the later 90s, just through friends. But and then we did a lot of social hangs, and I don't know if we. We did one or two gigs before he called me for Mule Kick. But it was very, sporadic. There was a lot of time in between.
Right on. Cool. And where is the best place people can connect with you or Split Second Meltdown online? Is it social media?
I avoided Facebook for 10 years, but now I have a page, a Split Second Meltdown page on it. And, for all the evils of Facebook, there are good things as well.
Right on.
And Instagram, yeah, Split Second Meltdown. And
which Facebook owns Instagram.
That, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and we will have links up to both of those in today's show notes, guys, on talkingmetal.com and right there on your Apple podcasting app. And big thanks to Rob for coming here to the house for another in-person interview. It's so great to get back to in-person interviews. A little editing is going to be needed here to clean up the dog craziness. Thanks for dealing with that, Rob. Yeah.
It was my pleasure, Mark. Thank you so much for having me.
And we can't wait to see you live. I may be away that first week in August. I'm not sure, but we will definitely be coming out to see you and support you live where and whenever you're playing.
Thank you.
Big thanks to Graham Oliver and Rob Clores for joining me on this episode of Talking Metal. And of course, a big thanks to you for listening. I will talk to you next time. Be safe this summer, guys. Stay cool. And again, I love you. Thanks for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.